The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
So, first of all, this week's portion is Ki Tetzeh, and wanted to share with you a couple of ideas. If this works, the goal is not to give answers. The goal is really to give you some food for thought. But I'll tell you a quick story that some of you may have heard before. I had a soldier. His name was Shai Tzinder. And he was a little bit of a tortured individual. He was going through a very tough time. I remember we came down from Lebanon. And he came from a kibbutz dati, from a religious kibbutz, whatever that means. And I kind of watched him get worn down by the army, piece by piece. Once I was an officer in the battalions, I didn't have a minyan. I didn't have a quorum of guys with which to learn or to pray with or whatever. But there was a little, you know, sort of a hut that they used as a makeshift synagogue, the Knesset. And I used to go there in the morning, like before inspections and before we started working on the tanks or before patrol, whenever I could catch it. And there was like two other guys, and he was one of them. And first I noticed he stopped coming in the morning to daven, to pray, stopped putting on tefillin. And then gradually, you know, I would see, like, you know, when we were going out or when guys had a chance to be, like, in town on their way back to base, he would sit with the guys in the Unkosher restaurant. And then gradually, you know, it was sort of a gradual process. And I was in a very different mode. I'm not a judgmental person anyway. So, you know, everybody has their speed. It was a little heartbreaking to watch because he was really being broken down. But, you know, when you're in the army, especially if you're an officer, you don't have a, you know, you don't really have the time to have deep theological and philosophical discussions with your men. You're in a different zone. And he was not actually in my company. He was in the other company. And, you know, they bought a television on the base. You know, sometimes we were up in Lebanon in the field, but sometimes we would get back to our main base for a few months at a time. And they had a television, and the guys would go and watch, like, you know, television when they weren't working on the tanks. And especially on Shabbat. On Shabbat, you don't do any service. You don't do maneuvers. So that's what the guys would do. They would go sit there. They would watch, like, wrestling, whatever it was that they watched on television all Shabbat afternoon. And he used to kind of, you know, at the beginning he would go, and he would just sit there, and then he would sit there. And, you know, he was kind of struggling. But he always wore a kippah. Anyway, one day he comes to me, and I'd been in the unit already a while. This was towards almost the end of my service. And he wanted to talk to me. And he said, the guys were always making fun of him. Because he would sit with them. He was, you know, he had good buddies, you're in the army. And he would sit and watch the wrestling on Shabbat afternoon, and he would sometimes eat the unkosher food, or whatever it might be that, you know, guys would buy outside. So they would say to him, Tagid, Tzinder, Oshta Dati, Oshta La Dati. You know, make up your mind. Are you religious? You're not religious. You wear a kippah, but you're sitting with us here. You know, most people don't know how to draw that line between letting people find their space. So he came to me, wanted my advice. He said, on the one hand, you know, I don't know if you could call me religious anymore. I'm not so into this stuff anymore. On the other hand, you know, I come from a religious kibbutz, and my parents are religious. And I know if I go home and I don't wear a kippah, you know, a skull cap on my head, you know, it'll be very hard on them. But on the other hand, like, to wear it when I'm home and to take it off when I go to the army and to wear it when I'm home. So what do you think I should do? Do you think if I'm not being religious and I'm doing all these things, and again, this is his words, not mine, I have a hard time describing anybody as irreligious if he's wearing an Israeli army uniform. How one defines religious is an interesting question, but, you know, do you think it's a problem? Do you think I should take my kippah off? You know, notice his question wasn't, how do I get back into a deep relationship with Judaism? So, you know, I mean, I'm 21 years old, young officer, I'm not in my rabbi mode. So I said to him, look, the only thing I can tell you for sure is that if you take off your kippah, it's much harder to put it back on. And, you know, the fact that you wear a kippah, the fact that that a kippah represents Jewish pride, etc., that stands for something. Anyway, he decided not to take off his kippah. About a week later, I rotated out, and the day that I finished with my unit, I had finished the army. I got home, I was watching the news, I was supposed to have a great day the next day. I was finally, after 4.5 years out of the army, there was an ambush. Jordanian soldiers snuck across the border, ambushed a patrol. This particular unit, my battalion, had rotated to what was supposed to be a relatively quiet zone along the Jordanian border, in the Bekaa, in the Jordan Valley. Soldiers snuck across the border, some Muslim fanatic. ambushed this patrol, and Shai, along with Ronen Reichler, was killed. And I ended up visiting, I went to the funeral and I visited the Shiva. And I remember telling his parents, you know, debated, should I tell them the story, should I not tell them the story? And I had a feeling that his parents knew that, you can't really hide something like that from your parents. And I told him, you should know that he struggled with it, he decided to keep his kippah on. He had a deep sense of Jewish pride. And it raises an interesting question, you know. We struggle with all sorts of things. And we do battle with all sorts of things. And, you know, before you can take a stand on something, before you can have an opinion, I think it's important to know where the other side is coming from. If you want to disagree with someone, this is a healthy rule to go through life with. If you want to disagree with someone, first understand where they're coming from. Understand their opinion, respect their opinion, then you can disagree with them. And the question of serving in the army, you know, this is a very difficult question in Israeli society today. Now, on the one hand, you have a whole population that believes that if we've been given a state of Israel after 2,000 years, there is actually a mitzvah to wage war in the event that there's a nation that rises up against you and wants to destroy you. We have a responsibility. This is our partnership with God. If we want God to give us this land and we want to earn it, unfortunately, we have to be willing to pay our dues. And if you sit and study Torah or you explore Jewish tradition, you still have to be willing to put on the uniform and to go out to battle if need be. But there's another population in this country that says, you know, if you put on a uniform and you go to the army, it wears you down. And it breaks you. And there aren't enough guys who are sitting and learning Torah. In 2,000 years, we dreamed of having a homeland. And the reason that we still have a relationship with this homeland is because of the Jewish tradition and Torah and everything else that involves. And so therefore, guys who are sitting and studying Torah, for that matter, men and women, they should be studying Torah. We shouldn't pull them away from their Torah studies in order to go to the army. And you could debate for the moment whether that point of view is legitimate. You can agree with it. You can disagree with it. One thing I will tell you, it is absolutely true that the army wears you down. It's very hard to stay connected to Jewish tradition, to theology, to a relationship with God, to a relationship with ritual. It's very hard to get up in the morning and put on tefillin or light your Shabbat candles or whatever relationship any individual has with their personal Jewish identity. It's very hard to maintain that on certain levels in the army. So I understand someone who says, I don't want to go to the army. And you look at a guy like Scheitzinger and you ask yourself, it's an interesting question. Was the price worth it? Is the struggle worth it? What is this battle that we seem to have to wage? And nearly 60 years after the birth of the State of Israel, we don't seem to be any closer to hanging our uniforms up in the cupboard. In fact, I'll tell you that the most difficult thing about making Aliyah to Israel, coming home to Israel, you know, we've come back now after a few years, absolutely without anything even close, is the reality that my sons are probably going to have to put on an Israeli army uniform. That's a heartbreaking thought. You know, and as a parent, you just don't want to go there. And you kind of ask yourself in the back of your mind, well, why do we need this? I mean, the Talmud says, Eretz Yisrael ena niknet ela al yedei yisurin. The relationship, the privilege of the relationship with the land of Israel is acquired through travail. It's hard work to develop a relationship with this land. And that involves, in our generation, being willing to go to war. It used to be, by the way, that you had a choice. I'm not even sure you have a choice anymore. You can live in Mea Shearim, which is an ultra-Orthodox neighborhood. Again, a definition that's very hard to understand or to define. But for the moment, for the purpose of conversation, and you think like you've made a decision maybe not to go to war, putting aside, by the way, that there are lots and lots of guys who, you know, ostensibly to the eye wear the long black frock coat and yet have served in the army and done all sorts of rotations. But putting that aside, you live in an ultra-Orthodox neighborhood, you live in Mea Shearim, you live in Bnei Brak, you're just almost just as much at war as everybody else. You're at war when you get on the bus. You're at war when you walk into a cafe and there's guards at the door. You're at war when you open up the news. Why is there this need for this constant battle? What does this struggle mean? What does it mean to go to war? This week's portion is actually the example par excellence of this particular issue. The first verse after which this portion is named basically sets the stage for this question. Ki teitse lemilchama al oyvecha, when you will go to war against your enemies. Right? That's a very difficult verse. It doesn't say if you go to war. There are those who suggest that the word ki can mean if you go to war, But that's not really an accurate translation for various reasons that we don't have the time to deal with. When you go to war. And based on this and other verses, and most of them are in this week's portion, the Talmud, and in the Talmud suit in the Gemara's wake, all of the halakhic authorities, Maimonides, the Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch of Rav Yosef Karo, rule that there are instances when you are actually obligated, there is a mitzvah to go to war. And if there's a mitzvah, if Hashem gives me a particular action that is an opportunity to develop a deeper relationship with myself, with the world around me, with God, whether it's putting on tefillin, lighting Shabbat candles, choosing not to eat on kosher meat, or going to war, that means that that is something that I will of necessity need in this world. It means that it's a part of the fabric of life. It's part of the ideal world, something that's meant to happen. And I want to understand that. Why does the world have to be a world where you will go to war? And what does it mean to go to war? What is war? Is war an ideal? Is war when all else fails? You know? If you read the newspapers in this country, if you ask around, you'll discover that there's an entire philosophy, and I'd like to believe that they're right, but of course this week's portion is going to challenge that, that says that war is not only an ideal state, it means we've failed. And I remember when I first started as a teacher, and this is an interesting question, I don't know if you can resolve this question, but I remember when I was in fifth grade, I had a teacher, very tough guy, and I would venture to say that if you counted the hours of my fifth grade year, I spent the majority of my time sitting out in the hallway. Whenever I talked out, whenever I had a problem, you know, for some reason I got on the hit list of this teacher, and I used to get sent out of class. And I always felt when you throw a student out of class, that means you failed. Sometimes you have to throw a student out of class for the benefit of the rest of the classroom. But with that individual student, you failed. If you can't find a way to keep that student in class and make it a productive experience, then you failed. And so one might suggest that when you go to war, it means you failed. So, is that true? Is the fact that we've not arrived at peace mean that we've failed? On the other hand, it doesn't only depend on you. We've spent the last 10 years trying everything we can think of to achieve peace, to achieve a state, even if not of peace, at least of non-belligerence, and we haven't succeeded. And I would venture to say that if you ask the average Israeli, or for that matter, the average Jew, or in the world, or maybe even the average lover of freedom and believer in truth, democracy, and open-mindedness, you would probably get a majority that believe that the Israelis have done everything that they can do to achieve peace. Certainly as much as we can think of. And that the other side isn't willing to sit down for whatever the reasons, so maybe we haven't failed. So how does that work? We're living in a world where because of someone else's failure, we have to go to war? How do you deal with that? And there's so many different avenues that this question can take. You know, it's kind of similar to driving along a highway. You can put your seatbelts on. You can maintain your car with perfect mechanical maintenance. You can drive under the speed limit. You can do everything that safety requires. And the guy across the meridian can still fall asleep and slam into your car. So does that mean that the late din, the late dayan, there's no justice and there's no judge? Is there a reason for it? Is it something we're ever meant to understand? What is the meaning of the concept of war? So I want to share with you an idea. It's not a long idea. I'd rather have a shorter idea and have a chance to discuss it afterwards. And if it motivates you to consider this question, especially given the period of time that we're in, then that's worthwhile. But maybe first just a few quick questions. First of all, I want you to know, this section, these portions that we read in these weeks, particularly this one, Ki tetzei lemilchama al-oyvecha, when you will go to war against your enemies, are always read in this period of time preceding Rosh Hashanah. This is somehow a continuation of the theme that we began discussing last week with the portion of Shoftim, right? The theme that somehow leads us to Rosh Hashanah, to that day when we stand before Hashem, when we experience the opportunity to be accountable for everything we've done, where we attempt to change who we are. What does going to war have to do with this theme? I would have thought that this would be a time to dream of how life could be. I would start a verse completely differently. Ki yavo shalom baratzecha, when peace will come in your land, that would be very, you know, cheerful. When peace arrives, then this is how you can experience the mitzvot, the opportunities to create love and harmony and peace. Create the dream, and then let's spend the next 3 weeks till Rosh Hashanah deciding how we live up to that dream, how we make that dream happen. And instead what the Torah does, it says, listen, I want you to know you're going to go to war. And when you go to war, here are the experiences that you will have. You'll take captives, you'll lose men, you'll suffer, you'll struggle. The entire theme of this week's parasha, on a certain level, seems to be all about the reality of war. As a matter of fact, it's interesting that the bookends of a portion, the beginning and the end of any portion, just like any other reality in life, are really the most demonstrative of what the theme of the entire portion is about. What is the end of this week's portion? This is a very famous section of a few verses that we actually read every year on the Shabbat preceding Purim. Right? This is one of the most difficult experiences that we had in the entire Torah. Zachor et asher asah lecha Amalek. Remember that which Amalek did to you, baderech, on the road. Betzeitchem mimitzrayim, when you were going out of Egypt. Interesting. Amalek didn't do this to us when we were coming to Israel. Amalek didn't do this to us as we were approaching Sinai, which is what I would have expected, because we'd crossed through the Red Sea. If you look at the 15th chapter, Perek Tedvav, of the book of Exodus, of Shemot, you'll find that this happened right after the splitting of the Red Sea. We left Egypt already. We split the sea. God split the sea. We got through it. The Egyptian army drowned in the sea. We're finished with Egypt. We're on our way to Israel. And on the way to Israel, we're going to go to Mount Sinai, and it's very clear that Mount Sinai is not the goal. Mount Sinai is a vehicle. It's a stepping stone on the way to achieving an ethical society and building it in the land of Israel. But it doesn't say when you were going to Sinai or when you were going to Israel. It says when you were leaving Egypt. So Amalek attacked you. Asher kocha baderech. When they happened to cross you on the road, which is a very difficult verse, and maybe in the Q&A afterwards we can talk about it, right? But when they happened to cross you, right? And vayezanev, and one way, by the way, of understanding that verse is actually a very chilling idea, that when the Jewish people were made cold, asher kocha, when we became cold, there is a comment of the Eish Kodesh. The Eish Kodesh of Klonim's Kalman Shapira was one of the last rabbis of the Warsaw Ghetto. And he has a very powerful paragraph on this in his commentary, which was part of a class, a series of classes that he gave in the ghetto under extremely difficult conditions. And he said, understand what this means. Amalek, the nation of Amalek, which ambushed us and nearly destroyed us and attacked the women and children in the rear and has come to epitomize pure evil, both on an allegorical as well as a realistic, on a mystical as well as a practical level. In fact, Soloveitchik suggests that every nation that rises up and wants to destroy the Jewish people simply because they are Jewish carry within them the seed of Amalek. He believed that Nazi Germany was the example par excellence in our generation of Amalek. And the Eish Kodesh clearly seemed to believe that this was so. The Eish Kodesh never mentioned the word Germans in his commentary, almost as though he didn't want to pollute his Torah classes with mention of the Nazi beast. But it's clear who he's talking about. And he speaks in his commentary, Asher kocha baderech, they made you cold. They presented you with an intellectual approach. They were so fine and so genteel and so mannered. And look what happened and who they became. And this Amalek that came to do battle with you, vayezanev b'chan, they came to your tail, kol anecha shalim acharecha, and attacked all the weak. And then that verse concludes, Timche et zecher Amalek, erase the memory of Amalek, mitachat hashamayim, from under the heavens, lo tishkach, do not forget. Very difficult series of verses. The portion begins with going out to war. It ends with the need to never forget what Amalek did. It's all about war. It's all about battle. It's all about struggle. Why is this theme leading up to Rosh Hashanah? Why does this theme have to be? Why must there be a mitzvah to go to war? Why is it an inevitable that we're going to go to war? And by the way, since we're already discussing this, as I mentioned before, why do we say ki tetzei lemilchama? Why do we go out to war? Why don't we come home to war? Why the need, when you really stop to think about it, of almost an assumption that there will be a war? So what is the nature of going out to war? I mean, why don't I come to war? Why don't I meet war? It's also interesting, and I don't know that we're going to get to answer all of this, but there's a line here that really makes no sense. Ki tetzei lemilchama al oyvecha. When you will go to war against your enemies. Well, you know, obviously you go to war against your enemies. You know, it used to be, it's interesting, when you watch your children grow up, there's like a stage that they reach where you realize that they're entering a new zone, right? You know, child is born, he's an infant, then he starts to crawl. Now he's in a different world. One day he gets out of diaper, he's in a new different world. So my personal opinion is that there's a particular point at which the maturing process of your children can be noticed. When we were kids, it was when you hit that zone, you know, when a kid would start to say, hello, McFly, you know, that certain cynicism that they can add to the table. Today it seems to be, you know, our 8-year-old, when she was 7, discovered the word duh. And, you know, I had to kind of remove this from her lexicon. Don't think it's so great when a child says to their parents, duh, right? But that's what this seems to be. Ki teitzeu milchama al-oivecha. Well, who else do you go to war with, if not your enemies? Now, the Torah doesn't waste words. If God's putting a recipe down on paper, God has done a lot of thinking and considered all the words in the Torah. Every word has a significance. So why does it have to tell me that I go to war against my enemies? I know I go to war against my enemies. Who else would you go to war with? Untano Hashem Elokecha bi'adecha, and God will give this enemy into your hands. That's a very, very powerful verse. You know, it doesn't really mean, if you look carefully, and this can be a discussion afterwards, if you go to war and if you win. It says if you will go to war against your enemies, Hashem will give you the victory. I don't know. Is that true? I mean, do we always win? Is this an assumption we can make? What's the purpose of war if we know we're going to win? What's the meaning of that victory? Veshavita shivyo, and you will then take captives, which is a whole other discussion that the parsha gets into here. Right? It's also interesting to note that God and the war, in terms of their relationship in this week's portion, seem to appear in an order that's rather different from what we might have expected. You know, you go to war, you go to war against your enemies, and then God comes along and gives you over the battle. I would have thought that God should appear in the verse before we go to war. If I don't have a relationship with God, then going to war is an entirely different experience. First, develop a relationship with God. I assume that if you go to war and God gives you a victory, then that entails, that means, that implies that there's some deep relationship with God even in that battle. So that should appear before I'm going to war. I should be, you know, maybe the verse could say, right, Ki tikra Hashem Elokecha, when you will call out to God, v'teitzei l'melchama, and you will go out to war. Doesn't say that. It's almost as though when you go to war, God isn't yet in the picture. And that's a very difficult question. What does that really mean? So what is war? What is going out to war? What is going out to war against your enemies? What does it mean that there seems to be this guarantee of war on a certain level, right? And I guess, by the way, one more thing, which you'll have to remind me at the end, but hopefully we'll get to it. The diction here is also not exactly correct. It should not say, ki teitzei l'milchama al oivecha, when you will go to war on your enemies. It should say, ki teitzei l'milchama be'oivecha, when you will go to war with or against your enemies. Ki teitzei l'milchama im oivecha, with your enemies. Why does it say on your enemies? The word al implies a certain superiority. It implies that I'm already on top of the game. That the reason that this victory comes, the reason that it's almost guaranteed, is because I already have the upper hand. That's something that's challenging on two levels. It's challenging historically. If you look at the history of the Jewish people in their battles, from the moment they enter the land of Israel, from the battles of Joshua when they were completely outnumbered, through all the battles of the judges when they were completely surrounded, when they were at the mercy almost. I mean, you look at the story, for example, of Shimshon, of Samson, and the Jewish people were completely at the mercy of the Plishtim, of the Philistines, of the coastal warriors who constantly came to steal their lands and their crops, etc., etc. The Canaanites, the Assyrians and the Amorites, the Babylonians, just one nation after the other against whom we have not only do not have an upper hand, but that just winning the war is a miracle in and of itself. So this doesn't make sense from a historical perspective. It should say, you know, ki tikrav, when you will come, or you will come close to do war against the enemies me'alecha, who are above you. That's one question. And then, of course, just on a mystical level. We don't only go to war when we have the upper hand. In fact, if you really have the upper hand and you're doing your job, that's when you don't go to war. One of the standard military doctrines that they teach you from the moment you enter commander's course is that the greatest challenge of a commander or of an officer is to create a scenario where your upper hand is so obvious that you prevent the battle from even happening. They teach you how to find the high ground. They teach you how to do hataya, how to confuse the enemy and trick the enemy into thinking that you have larger forces than you have. There was a famous story of a fellow by the name of Tzvika, and he, you know, basically arrived up at the front lines in the Yom Kippur War in the first hours of the war. There was no one up there. I mean, there were some of you have heard this story before, but you know, the 77th Battalion of Avigdor Kalani, which was part of the 7th Brigade of Yanush, was completely outnumbered. There were maybe 75 tanks on the line. There were 650 Syrian tanks pouring through that northern piece of the Golan Heights. They were completely outnumbered. Tzvika came. They didn't even have their crews organized because the reservists had not yet arrived. So people were getting to the staging area, and it was chaos. And they were just looking at guys and saying, okay, you're a driver, you're a loader, you're a gunner, you're a commander, good, grab this tank, go. Well, go where? Well, just go. Find the lines. Well, what's the radio frequency? Well, it doesn't matter. We'll give it to you on the way. So Tzvika managed to put together a small force of 3 tanks, and eventually 2 tanks. And he went out into the field, and they ran out of ammo, they ran out of gas, he had his tank shot out from under him 3 times. They basically sort of traversed some 15 kilometers of area, which is a huge amount of area for such a small force, and they would fire at a number of tanks, and hopefully take out a few, and then they would travel a couple kilometers and fire at some more tanks, and his whole goal was to create the illusion that he was a much larger force than he was. And in fact, he received the highest military honor, decorated for bravery after the Yom Kippur War, and we, post-Yom Kippur War, you know, a lot of intelligence fell into our hands, including some of the radio traffic from the Syrian command. And they actually thought that there were 2 extra brigades that were up on the Golan Heights because of Koch Tzvika. And that's one theory as to why they slowed down their advance. And that's exactly what you have to do. You create the upper hand. And when you create the upper hand, well, then hopefully you don't have to fight. Here, it seems when you have the upper hand, that's when you go to war. What does that mean? How do you do that? Why do I need to go to war if I have the upper hand? And what relationship does this have, right, between the concept of war itself and the need to go to war? So, at the risk of maybe getting a little too political, but I'm going to try to avoid that, although again, you know, in about 10, 15 minutes when we get into some discussion, I'm more than open to the topic. But it strikes me that there are really 2 issues in defining a war. When do you go to war? What makes a war? There are 2 things that allow for a war to happen. One is, you have to have enemies. You don't go to war if you have no enemies. And what that means is not only that an enemy arises against you, but you have to know who your enemy is. One of the greatest challenges on a military level and on other levels that we'll get to in a minute is when I don't even know who my enemy is. The best example I can think of is the Vietnam War. When America went to Vietnam, throughout almost 10 years of conflict, America never declared war against North Vietnam. Not the Congress, not the Senate, not the President, they never declared war. And that had enormous ramifications. First of all, it had ramifications in terms of funding, it had ramifications in terms of how many personnel were sent into the field, it impacted the press, it impacted the public. There are many who would suggest that the fact that America never declared war against Vietnam, that might well be one of the major reasons that we lost. In fact, it's even more interesting because if you ever take a close look, and I don't have time in my life to spend, you know, years studying military doctrine, but if you do a little reading, even a cursory look at the Vietnam War, you will discover that we actually won that war. The Tet Offensive in 1968, when, you know, North Vietnam unleashed all across the border an incredible array of attacks, was actually beaten back, and the majority of the military command of North Vietnam was taken out. We lost that war in the press. And the reason we lost that war in the press was because we didn't really declare war. And the reason we didn't really declare war was because the majority of the American public, the majority of the American press, and maybe even the majority of the American government did not, so it seems with hindsight, believe that this was our enemy. Now, you can debate this, and of course this is a very right-wing approach, and there is another side to this, and I'm not, you know, I don't want to get into politics. I mean, you know, obviously, if we stopped that war, and thank God we did, because who knows how many more tens of thousands of boys would have been killed. But at the end of the day, when you don't declare war, when you don't know who your enemy is, that is the surest recipe for making sure that you can't win. The other, of course, which is directly related to that, is you have to be willing to go out and fight. You have to believe that there's something worth fighting for. You have to believe that that fight is the correct thing to do. And you have to be willing to get to go out and to do battle. You know, I this is true on so many levels. You know, one of the most shocking experiences for me in my entire army service was, you know, they were sending us nispachim. They were, we were short manpower. We were going up to Lebanon. We were heading for a very difficult area. This was already 3 years into the Lebanon War. We were already down above the Awali River. And, you know, Israel had already gotten itself into a series of messes, you know, in Jezzine and in Rashidiya and all the area going up towards Beirut. And we were supposed to pick up a number of reserve duty soldiers. And because of the nature of, you know, the hot zones that we were in, so you had to send a vehicle with a livui, with an accompanying vehicle, to bring them up to your base up deep in Lebanon, right? And an officer always had to accompany the patrol. So I came down to Marjaon, which is like the tip of the southern Lebanese border with Israel, above Kiryat Shmona and Metula, and I was supposed to pick up, you know, three guys, and we were supposed to bring them back up to our base. And one of them was very important because he was a driver, and, you know, there weren't enough drivers. And the guy was actually there, and he refused to cross the border into Lebanon. And he was basically, it's the first time I ever met an Israeli Jewish soldier who was a conscientious objector. And, you know, of course, that carries dilemmas in and of itself, because on the one hand, you know, if you feel that something is unjust, we're blessed to live in a society where you have the right to protest, and you have to be willing to pay the price for that protest, just like, you know, Martin Luther King did. On the other hand, it was the first time I ever met, you know, someone wearing an Israeli army uniform who just didn't believe in what he was fighting for. It was a heartbreaking experience. Totally irrelevant to whether he was right or wrong, whether I think he was right or wrong, just the concept. And it to this day, frightens the Israeli military to no end, because we're such a small country, our ability to survive, at least on this level, putting aside the mystical and our relationship with God, has much to do with the fact that people believe in what we're doing. So, you need those two things. You need the ability to go to war. I'm sorry, the ability to know your enemy. You have to have an enemy. You have to know you have an enemy. And you have to be willing to fight it. Right? And it's interesting that that may well be why the verse says, Ki teitzei lemilchama, when you will go out to war. Right? It's only if you're willing to go out to war that there's a war to fight. And what's challenging about that is that it seems to be that the ability, the willingness to go out to do battle is, on the one hand, a principle of war, and on the other hand, it seems to be some sort of an ideal, right? So what is milchama? What is war? So it's an interesting question on so many different levels, you know. Jewish tradition teaches that the word milchama is really made up of two words. It's, on the one hand, the word lechem, bread, because wars are fought over bread. A war is very much often fought over the realities of this world, you know. And the word Hashem, the Hey of God, the name of God. And there's an incredible pre-tzadik, Tzidkat HaTzadik, or Tzadik HaKohen of Lublin, who suggests that there is no experience like war to allow a person to see the balance between the illusion on the one hand and the reality on the other, you know. One of the questions that you come face to face with in a war is who really runs the world? Who runs the world? You know? Do you believe that it's really dependent on what you see? Or do you believe that what you see in the end of the day is an illusion and it's much bigger than that? You know, it's like they say in the army, bullets, they don't know about statistics. You know, one of the questions that you get asked all the time whenever the topic of Israel comes up, you know, we used to run, planning to start running it again soon, God willing, you know, when we run our programs here in Israel. So people always ask me, well, is it safe? Is it safe to go to Israel? It's a crazy question. How do you answer a question like that? So there's the statistical answer. You know, if you want to know, statistically, are you as safe walking on the beach in Tel Aviv as you are, you know, driving up I-95? Statistically, yeah, you probably are. There are probably a lot of things that we do that statistically are not at all safe. And we do them because, you know, we've gotten used to them, right? And so if you run up a hill and you're being fired at, the statistical probability that one of those bullets is actually going to hit you when there's so many men and so many bullets is actually pretty low. And that's why when a battle is over and you have hundreds of men, you know, you'll hear, God forbid, 3 people were killed, 2 people were killed, because those are the statistics. But on the other hand, you know, bullets don't know about statistics. And if your number's up, your number's up. It doesn't matter that you were the one that was outside the realm of statistics. You know, to run up a hill under enemy fire, you almost have to believe that it has nothing to do with you. Because if you really thought that your survival depended only on what you did, you would have to be nuts to run up a hill under fire. And there's an incredible text of the Rambam, Maimonides. Maimonides discusses these topics in Hilchot Melachim, in the laws of kings, the last section of law in the entire Maimonidean code. It's in the book called Shoftim, Judges, right? And in the 7th chapter, Perek Zayin, in the 15th halacha, I used to have this pasted on the side of my turret in my tank, right, when I was a commander. It's an incredible halacha, right? It says, Mi aish hayarei v'rach levav, right? Who is the man who is afraid or in awe and soft-hearted, speaking of those who, at least in a voluntary war, don't have to go to fight, right? She'en b'libo koach la'amod b'kishrei milchama. A person who does not have in his heart the strength to stand up to the challenges of war. You know, there's some people, you know, we call them yafei nefesh. They're just sweet souls. And they weren't made to go to war. And they can't handle it. You know, if you know you're such a person, find a way to serve the country without going to war, because you're not going to be doing anybody any favors if you're running up a hill and you're terrified and you can't get out of your turret. U'me'achar she'ikanes b'kishrei melchama, but the Rambam says, and after you will go into the travails, to the challenges, to the tests of war, right? Gish'an al mikveh Yisrael. What do you do? What do you think of? How do you overcome the natural fear? You can lean on the wellspring of Israel, u'moshiyo, and its Savior. Be'etzara, in times of trouble. V'yeda she'al yichud Hashem hu osem melchama. And a person, if you go to war and you're struggling with this, the challenge is in your mind. You know, somebody asked me, is it safe to go to Israel? To me, the issue is not statistically is it safe. To me, the question is, are you going to feel safe? You know? There are some people, they can walk through the Gaza Strip, and they feel that they're totally in God's hands, and they feel safe. You know? I meet people, I was just today doing a siur, I was, heading around the perimeter of Efrat, I was doing a, you know, sort of security breakdown for all sorts of reasons that I'm not going to talk about on the phone. And, you know, the northern tip of Efrat looks out on Efrat and on Beit Lechem and some of the Arab villages there, and I needed to get apprised of, you know, what's changed strategically in the last 3 years. You look out there and you see north, and, you know, you know that you're in at least heavy gunfire range. And people live there. And, you know, in the year 2000, there was actually shooting that took place. And so I was talking to somebody who lives there, and I was saying, you know, do people still feel that tension? He started laughing at me. He said, what do you mean? You know, who thinks about that? We go, we play ball, we have a good time. You don't live with that. You know, if you can live under that circumstance and you can put it out of your head, it's an incredible existence. It's beautiful. You look out at the mountains and the vineyards. Some people aren't built for that. And so at the end of the day, it's almost as though war is in your mind. And the challenge then becomes, where do you put your mind? But that still leaves me with the question of why I need that. Why do I need to have that struggle? Why do I need to have those enemies against whom I have to be willing to fight, and with whom I have to be willing to make war? What is the purpose, or what is the underlying meaning of war? So maybe the way to understand this is to take a different perspective. Let go for the moment of war as conflict. And imagine that the wars that we're speaking of are a totally different type of war. And Rav Avadia Yosef, in his, I think it's in his Haggadah of Passover, of Pesach, but I might be wrong, it might be in his commentary before Rosh Hashanah, suggests, and there are many commentaries who say this, that the reason that these verses appear here is because as we go into the month of Elul, to a certain degree, you have to be willing to wage war. You have to first know who your enemy is. You know, people talk about the fact that you don't make peace with your friends. You have to be willing to make peace with your enemies. And, of course, the answer or the response that seems to make sense to me in such circumstances, it's true you make peace with your enemies, but you have to make peace with an enemy who wants to make peace with you. And in the history of warfare, there has never been a conflict that has been resolved without victory. You don't sit down to the negotiating table until somebody's won. And sometimes winning actually means decimating the other side. You know, that's what America did in World War II. And sometimes it means that the enemy just realizes that the jig is up. They're just not going to win, and they're clever enough to let go before it gets worse. But somebody wins. And once somebody wins, then the enemy is ready to sit down and make peace. That may be, by the way, one of our biggest challenges today. We have this perspective on peace. We believe that we have to be willing to do anything to create peace. But sometimes, if you're trying to create peace before you've finished winning a war, you actually create more warfare. You know? If America had, in its quest for peace, decided to actually declare war years earlier in World War II, and instead of waiting until really December of 1941 when they almost no longer had a choice, if they had declared war along with Britain and Nazi Germany even before Britain did in 1938 when Hitler took the Sudetenland, there millions of people would have been spared. Sometimes the decision to hold out for peace before an enemy knows that he's been vanquished causes more war. On a personal level, it gets much deeper. Because the question is, against what do I need to do battle? What are the things in my life that bring me down? What are the enemies that I have? Who are my enemies? Why does it say, Ki teitzei l'milchama al oyvecha? Because so often, the things that we perceive to be those things that help us out, those are our greatest challenges. What is the oyev? How do I recognize the oyev? You know? You wake up in the morning, and you need to sleep. You need to, you know, it's good for you. You're short on sleep, so sleep late. Stay in bed till 11:30, it'll be healthier. You know, health professionals suggest that there's a sleep pattern a person's supposed to get into. And sometimes sleeping later actually isn't healthy. You know, it can undo your equilibrium, it can affect your mental health. People who are depressed can't get out of bed. Sometimes that which I perceive to be my greatest friend is my greatest enemy. And so on and so forth. And the real challenge is, am I willing almost to step out of the box and be willing to do battle against those things that I so often have perceived to be my greatest friends? You know? There's an interesting Talmudic, and we're almost done and then I'll take questions. There's an interesting Talmudic discussion in the Tractate of Bava Metzia. There's a whole discussion there about property disputes. And in one of them, it suggests that if two litigants are arguing over land, Zeomer Shalavotai Vezeomer Shalavotai. This one says that it belongs to my forefathers, and this one says it belongs to mine. And if neither one of them has any evidence, no contracts, no witnesses, no having sojourned on the land long enough to demonstrate ownership, and they come to the Beit Din, they come to the court. So the court basically tells them, look, you know, we can't help you. I mean, you know, you say it's yours, and you say it's yours, and you know, we're talking about actually in this case not even a piece of land. We're talking about also sometimes something like a boat which is out to sea. We don't even have the item in front of us. So the Talmud gives an incredible response. The court will tell two such litigants, Kol dalim gvar, whoever is stronger, he'll overcome. In other words, look, what can we tell you? You have no evidence. You haven't presented us with a case we can give an opinion on. So go fight it out. Figure it out. Whoever wins, wins. What can we tell you? So that's unbelievable. A court of law is telling two litigants to go fight it out? I would have expected the Talmud to say, okay, at this point, this becomes court property until such time as you can display evidence. And we'll turn it into a public park, but that's not what we say. So the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, who was the father of the Torah, one of the fathers of the codes of Jewish law that we have till this day, he actually ended up moving to Toledo, Spain. He lived at the end of the 14th century. He was really one of the great fathers of Ashkenazic halachic ruling. He explains that the basis of this ruling in the Talmud, in the Gemara Bava Metzia, is that if something's really yours, you have to be willing to fight for it. You have to be willing to fight for it. And if that's true on a practical, strategic, military level in terms of what's going on in the world today, it's true also on a personal level. You know, there is no greater possession that we have than ourselves. our perspective on this world, who we are, who we can become, and how we get there. There is nothing greater that we own in this world, and if there's anything that we really own in this world, it's maybe only that. And the question is, are we willing to struggle with that? Are we willing to fight for that? Life becomes so comfortable. We fall into our grooves and into our routines, and we get used to things. It's been such an incredible awakening to me to realize over 3 years in America how many things you get used to that you don't even realize you get used to. And how easy it is to get used to other things if you will just decide to do that. You know? And that really is the challenge of this week's portion. You know? Ki tetzei lemilchama. Are you willing to put a little energy into it? Are you willing to do a little battle? Are you willing to struggle to become something better? Are you willing to step out of the box? And there is no objective black and white as to what that struggle is, because for each of us it's different. For each community it's different. You know, there are certain things that we do, there are certain patterns that we fall into. We've become so comfortable. The pasuk, the verse says at the end of Deuteronomy of Tvarim, Vayishman Yishurun Vayivat. Yishurun is one of the names for the Jewish people. When we will become fat, we will kick back almost, rebel against who we really are and against who created us. And that's a reality that we're experiencing all over the Jewish world. And in order to combat that, in order to change, in order to become the Jewish people we were meant to be, we have to be willing to struggle with the realities we've become used to, and to figure out how we can step outside of our box and change who we really are. And that's a little bit of food for thought. There is so much more to talk about, just as this window. But like I said, I didn't want to present all the answers. I thought maybe we'd open up a topic. I'll tell you, by the way, a very interesting thing. All right, listen to this. I just saw this in the Torah Tamima, which is a commentary that brings Talmudic sources on the whole Torah. You know, this week's portion, this is something to think about over lunch. There's a whole discussion about rape. It's a very difficult topic. And it's interesting that, according to the Talmud and Sanhedrin, if you're walking through a field and you see someone about to rape a woman, right, you obviously are obligated to stop them. You're liable if you don't stop them. And you're even allowed to kill a person. If the only way to prevent the rape, in this case of a betrothed woman, is to kill him, you're actually allowed to kill a person to prevent the rape. Now, let me ask you an interesting question. Suppose, right, and of course if you see someone about to murder someone, etc. So it's an interesting question, where does that stop? And this fits with the discussion we just had. So suppose I'm walking along, and I see somebody about to commit idolatry, right? Now, idolatry is not only a crime punishable by death, of course how you define it is difficult, but in fact it's one of only three categories, three mitzvot, that I have to be willing to die for, right? Adultery, or whatever, that would include rape, idolatry, and murder. Right? If somebody tells me to desecrate Shabbat or die, I'm obligated to desecrate Shabbat in most circumstances. So if I see someone about to commit idolatry, and I can stop him, and the only way I can stop him from committing idolatry, public idolatry, is to kill him, am I obligated to kill him? Am I allowed to kill him? Would I be held liable for killing him? And the Torah Tamima, based on the Talmud, points out, and this is how we rule halachically, you're not allowed to kill him. It's very interesting. You're allowed to kill a person to stop a rape, which at the end of the day, I mean, they don't murder a person, not that I'm mitigating what a terrible crime that is, but you're not allowed to kill a person to prevent idolatry. The whole theme of this week's portion is about the balance, not only in terms of being able to recognize what I have to do battle against, but being able to recognize the priorities in what I do battle against. You know, God's willing to let slide a little our relationship with him, her, it, has a much harder time letting slide our relationship with our fellow human beings, which may also fit sort of leading up to Rosh Hashanah. By the way, I didn't get to that, but I hope it's pretty clear, A, why this is naturally a theme leading up to Rosh Hashanah, and B, why it says, you know, that you go do battle against your enemy, because that's the whole point, and why it's aloi vecha. You know, one of the challenges, not only what you do battle, what you struggle with, but when you're ready to struggle. Sometimes people struggle with things before they're ready for it. You know, the best example I can think of is marriage. You know, you meet someone and they're so desperately looking to find the right person, and they're deep into that struggle, but they haven't yet figured out who they are. You know, before you can find the right person to marry, you have to become the right person so that the right person can find you. And sometimes it's not just about being willing to struggle, it's about knowing where your struggle needs to be right now. I mean, this is our biggest problem in Israel. You know, people just naturally assume that the enemy are living, you know, in Arab villages, they're a symptom. Our greatest enemy is ourselves. The social issues in Israel are much, much, much more difficult and much more challenging. and much more the root of the problem, educationally and everything else, than the Arab world around us. I hope you all have a wonderful, wonderful Shana Tova. I'll look forward to seeing some of you soon. And Shana Tova and Shabbat Shalom.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.